Hello, friends. I'm not sure if any of you need to hear this, but I certainly do. Be patient with yourself, and try to be patient with others. It's not easy, especially for the perfectionists among us. But we are all going through a lot right now, and we're all doing the best we can. You know, there couldn't be a better time to emerge from the dark depths of our inner sanctum than this week. The week of All Hallows' Eve. We have arrived at your virtual doorstep to deliver this trick that is also a treat. It's an all-new ghostly entry from our Midnight Reading series. Well, we hate to drop this little goodie and run, but just know we are hard at work in our mad scientist's laboratory creating all-new content for an all-new season of thrilling entertainment. COVID-19 be damned. You can't keep a good ghoul down. As for some of the terrors provided by the endless news cycle these days, we admit we can't compete. But in the meantime, we look forward to offering deliciously dark distractions that will create a much preferable variety of suspense. And now, please enjoy this eerie journey into the fantastic. Happy Halloween.
In the dark of night, one light still yet burns. Frightened fingers tremble as brittle pages turn. Fireside Mystery Theater presents The Midnight Reading, a special series of dramatic recitations of dark masterpieces in miniature by the masters of the macabre. Good evening. I'm James Reeser. Rhoda Broughton. Not a name one hears anymore. It's a shame, because back in her Victorian heyday, this wry Welsh woman had a knack for raising hackles with her novels that were considered scandalous in their day. So much so that many of them were banned from circulating libraries for much of her lifetime. This, however, did nothing to diminish their popularity. For example, the captain of the HMS Alert named a mountain in her honor, since he and his crew heartily devoured all of her books during their long voyages. I am also happy to report that among Rhoda Broughton's strengths, as you're about to find out, was that she knew her way around a good ghost story. What's particularly interesting about this entry is its epistolary format. A disquieting tale reveals itself through an exchange of letters between two society women. Here to read the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, is our own Ali Silva.
The truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. By Rhoda Broughton. Mrs. De Wint to Mrs. Montresor. 18 Eccleston Square, May 5th. My dearest Cecilia, talk of the friendships of Orestes and Pylades, of Julie and Claire, what are they to ours? Did Pylades ever go ventre à terre, half over London on a day more broiling than any, but an âme damnée could even imagine, in order that Orestes might be comfortably housed for the season? Did Claire ever hold sweet converse with from 50 to 100 house agents, in order that Julie might have 3 windows to her drawing room and a pretty portiere? You see, I am determined not to be done out of my full meed of gratitude. Well, my friend, I had no idea till yesterday how closely we were packed in this great smoky beehive, as tightly as herrings in a barrel. Don't be frightened, however. By dint of squeezing and crowding, we have managed to make room for 2 more herrings in our barrel, and those 2 are yourself and your other self, i.e. your husband. Let me begin at the beginning. After having looked over, I verily believe, every undesirable residence in West London, after having seen nothing intermediate between what was suited to the means of a duke and what was suited to the needs of a chimney sweep, after having felt bed ticking and explored kitchen ranges till my brain reeled under my accumulated experience, I arrived at about 5:30 yesterday afternoon at 32 Waverton Street, Mayfair. Failure number 253, I don't doubt. I said to myself as I toiled up the steps with my soul athirst for afternoon tea, and feeling as ill-tempered as you please. So much for my spirit of prophecy. Fate, I have noticed, is often fond of contradicting us flat and giving the lie to our little predictions. Once inside, I thought I had got into a small compartment of heaven by mistake. Fresh as a daisy, clean as a cherry, bright as a seraph's face, it is all these and 100 more, only that my limited stock of similes is exhausted. 2 drawing rooms as pretty as ever woman crammed with people she did not care 2 straws about. White curtains with rose-coloured ones underneath, festooned in the sweetest way. Marvellously, immorally becoming, my dear, as I ascertained entirely for your benefit, in the mirrors of which there are about 12.5. Persian mats, easy chairs, and lounges suited to every possible physical conformation, from the Apollo Belvedere to Miss Biffin, and 1,000 of the important little trivialities that make up the sum of a woman's life. Peacock fans, Japanese screens, naked boys and décolleté shepherdesses, not to speak of a family of china pugs with blue ribbons round their necks, which ought of themselves to have added £50 a year to the rent. Apropos, I asked in fear and trembling, what the rent might be. £300 a year. A feather would have knocked me down. I could hardly believe my ears, and made the woman repeat it several times, that there might be no mistake. To this hour it is a mystery to me. With that suspiciousness which is so characteristic of you, you will immediately begin to hint that there must be some terrible, unaccountable smell, or some odious, inexplicable noise haunting the reception rooms. Nothing of the kind, the woman assured me, and she did not look as if she were telling stories. You will suggest next, remembering the rose-coloured curtains, that its last occupant was a member of the demi-monde. Wrong again! Its last occupant was an elderly and unexceptionable Indian officer, without a liver and with a most lawful wife. They did not stay long, it is true, but then, as the housekeeper told me, he was a deplorable old hypochondriac who could never bear to stay a fortnight at any one place. So lay aside that scepticism, which is your besetting sin, and give unfeigned thanks to St. Brigitta, or St. Gingulfa, or St. Catherine of Siena, or whoever is your tutelar saint, for having provided you with a palace at the cost of a hovel, and for having sent you such an invaluable friend as, your attached, Elizabeth de Wint. P.S. I am so sorry I shall not be in town to witness your first raptures, but dear Artie looks so pale and thin and tall after the whooping cough that I am sending him off at once to the sea, and as I cannot bear the child out of my sight, I am going into banishment likewise. Mrs. Montresor to Mrs. de Wint. 32 Waverton Street, Mayfair, May 14th. Dearest Bessie, why did not little Artie defer his whooping cough convalescence till August? It is very odd to me, the perverse way in which children always fix upon the most inconvenient times and seasons for their diseases. Here we are, installed in our paradise, and have searched high and low in every hole and corner for the serpent, without succeeding in catching a glimpse of his spotted tail. Most things in this world are disappointing, but 32 Waverton Street, Mayfair, is not. The mystery of the rent is still a mystery. I have been for my first ride in the Row this morning. My horse was a little fidgety. I am half afraid that my nerve is not what it was. I saw heaps of people I knew. Do you recollect Florence Watson? What a wealth of red hair she had last year. Well, that same wealth is black as the raven's wing this year. I wonder how people can make such walking impositions of themselves, don't you? Adela comes to us next week. I am so glad. It is dull driving by oneself of an afternoon, and I always think that one young woman alone in a brougham, or with only a dog beside her, does not look good. We sent round our cards a fortnight before we came up, and have been already deluged with callers. considering that we have been 2 years exiled from civilized life, and that London memories are not generally of the longest, we shall do pretty well, I think. Rafe Gordon came to see me on Sunday. He is in the 11th Hussars now. He has grown up such a dear fellow, and so good-looking. Just my style, large and fair and whiskerless. Most men nowadays make themselves as like monkeys, or Scotch terriers as they possibly can. I intend to be quite a mother to him. Dresses are gored to as indecent an extent as ever. Short skirts are rampant. I am sorry, I hate them. They make tall women look lank and short ones insignificant. A knock! Peace is a word that might as well be expunged from one's London dictionary. Yours affectionately, Cecilia Montresor. Mrs. De Wint to Mrs. Montresor. The Lord Warden, Dover, May 18th. Dearest Cecilia, you will perceive that I am about to devote only one small sheet of notepaper to you. This is from no dearth of time, heaven knows. Time is a drug in the market here, but from a total dearth of ideas. Any ideas that I ever have come to me from without, from external objects. I am not clever enough to generate any within myself. My life here is not an eminently suggestive one. It is spent digging with a wooden spade and eating prawns. Those are my employments, at least. My relaxation is going down to the pier to see the Calais boat come in. When one is miserable oneself, it is decidedly consolatory to see someone more miserable still. And wretched and bored and reluctant vegetable as I am not seasick. I always feel my spirits rise after having seen that peevish, draggled procession of blue, green, and yellow fellow Christians file past me. There is a wind here always, in comparison of which the wind that behaved so violently to the corners of Job's house was a mere zephyr. There are heights to climb, which require more daring perseverance than ever wolf displayed with his paltry heights of Abraham. There are glaring white houses, glaring white roads, glaring white cliffs. If anyone knew how unpatriotically I detest the chalk cliffs of Albion. Having grumbled through my two little pages, I have actually been reduced to writing very large in order to fill even them. I will send off my dreary little billet. How I wish I could get into the envelope myself, too, and whirl up with it to dear, beautiful, filthy London. Not more heavily could Madame de Stael have sighed for Paris from among the shades of Coppet. Your disconsolate, Bessie. Mrs. Montresor to Mrs. De Wint. 32 Waverton Street, Mayfair, May 27th. Oh, my dearest Bessie. How I wish we were out of this dreadful, dreadful house. Please don't think me ungrateful for saying this, after your taking such pains to provide us with a heaven upon earth, as you thought. What has happened could, of course, have neither been foretold nor guarded against by any human being. About 10 days ago, Benson, my maid, came to me with a very long face and said, "If you please, 'em, did you know that this house was haunted?" I was so startled, you know what a coward I am. I said, "Good heavens, no, is it?" "Well, 'em, I'm pretty nigh sure it is," she said. And the expression of her countenance was about as lively as an undertaker's, and then she told me that Cook had been that morning to order groceries from a shop in the neighbourhood, and on her giving the man the direction where to send the things to, he had said with a very peculiar smile, "Number 32, Waverton Street, eh? I wonder how long you'll stand it. Last lot held out just a fortnight." He looked so odd that she asked him what he meant, but he only said,
"Oh, nothing. Only that parties never do stay long at 32.
He had known parties go in one day and out the next, and during the last 4 years he had never known any remain over the month. Feeling a good deal alarmed by this information, she naturally inquired the reason, but he declined to give it, saying that if she had not found it out for herself, she had much better leave it alone, as it would only frighten her out of her wits, and on her insisting and urging him, she could only extract from him that the house had such a villainously bad name that the owners were glad to let it for a mere song. You know how firmly I believe in apparitions, and what an unutterable fear I have of them. Anything material, tangible, that I can lay hold of, anything of the same fibre, blood, and bone as myself, I could, I think, confront bravely enough. But the mere thought of being brought face to face with the bodiless dead makes my brain unsteady. The moment Henry came in, I ran to him and told him, but he pooh-poohed the whole story, laughed at me, and asked whether we should turn out of the prettiest house in London at the very height of the season, because a grocer said it had a bad name. Most good things that had ever been in the world had had a bad name in their day, and moreover, the man had probably a motive for taking away the house's character, some friend for whom he coveted the charming situation and the low rent. He derided my babyish fears, as he called them, to such an extent that I felt half ashamed, and yet not quite comfortable either. And then came the usual rush of London engagements, during which one has no time to think of anything but how to speak and act and look for the moment then present. Adela was to arrive yesterday, and in the morning our weekly hamper of flowers, fruit and vegetables arrived from home. I always dress the flower vases myself. Servants are so tasteless. And as I was arranging them, it occurred to me, you know Adela's passion for flowers, or to carry up one particular cornucopia of roses and mignonette and set it on her toilet table as a pleasant surprise for her. As I came downstairs, I had seen the housemaid, a fresh, round-faced country girl, go into the room which was being prepared for Adela, with the pair of sheets that she had been airing over her arm. I went upstairs very slowly, as my cornucopia was full of water, and I was afraid of spilling some. I turned the handle of the bedroom door and entered, keeping my eyes fixed on my flowers to see how they bore the transit and whether any of them had fallen out. Suddenly, a sort of shiver passed over me, and feeling frightened, I did not know why, I looked up quickly. The girl was standing by the bed, leaning forward a little with her hands clenched in each other, rigid, every nerve tense, her eyes wide open, starting out of her head, and a look of unutterable stony horror in them, her cheeks and mouth not pale, but livid as those of one that died a while ago in mortal pain. As I looked at her, her lips moved a little, and an awful hoarse voice, not like hers in the least, said, "Oh, my God, I have seen it." And then she fell down suddenly, like a log, with a heavy noise. Hearing the noise, loudly audible all through the thin walls and floors of a London house, Benson came running in, and between us we managed to lift her onto the bed and tried to bring her to herself by rubbing her feet and hands and holding strong salts to her nostrils. And all the while we kept glancing over our shoulders in a vague, cold terror of seeing some awful shapeless apparition. 2 long hours she lay in a state of utter unconsciousness. Meanwhile, Henry, who had been down to his club, returned. At the end of 2 hours we succeeded in bringing her back to sensation and life, but only to make the awful discovery that she was raving mad. She became so violent that it required all the combined strength of Henry and Phillips, our butler, to hold her down in the bed. Of course, we sent off instantly for a doctor, who, on her growing a little calmer towards evening, removed her in a cab to his own house. He has just been here to tell me that she is now pretty quiet, not from any return to sanity, but from sheer exhaustion. We are, of course, utterly in the dark as to what she saw, and her ravings are far too disconnected and unintelligible to afford us the slightest clue.
I feel so completely shattered and upset by this awful occurrence that you will excuse me, dear. I'm sure if I write incoherently. One thing I need hardly tell you, and that is that no earthly consideration would induce me to allow Adela to occupy that terrible room. I shudder and run by quickly as I pass the door. Yours, in great agitation, Cecilia.
Mrs. De Wint to Mrs. Montresor. The Lord Warden, Dover, May 28th. Dearest Cecilia, yours just come. How very dreadful. But I am still unconvinced as to the house being in fault. You know I feel a sort of godmother to it, and responsible for its good behaviour. Don't you think that what the girl had might have been a fit? Why not? I myself have a cousin who is subject to seizures of the kind, and immediately on being attacked, his whole body becomes rigid, his eyes glassy and staring, his complexion livid, exactly as in the case you describe. Or, if not a fit, are you sure that she has not been subject to fits of madness? Please be sure and ascertain whether there's not insanity in her family. It is so common nowadays, and so much on the increase, that nothing is more likely. You know my utter disbelief in ghosts. I am convinced that most of them, if run to earth, would turn out about as genuine as the famed Cock Lane one. But even allowing the possibility, nay, the actual unquestioned existence of ghosts in the abstract, is it likely that there should be anything to be seen so horribly fear-inspiring as to send a perfectly sane person in one instant raving mad, which you, after 3 weeks' residence in the house, have never caught a glimpse of? According to your hypothesis, your whole household ought by this time to be stark staring mad. Let me implore you not to give way to a panic which may, possibly, probably, prove utterly groundless. Oh, how I wish I were with you to make you listen to reason. Artie ought to be the best prop ever woman's old age was furnished with to indemnify me for all he and his whooping cough have made me suffer. Write immediately, please, and tell me how the poor patient progresses. Oh, had I the wings of a dove, I shall be on wires till I hear again. Yours, Bessie.
Mrs. Montresor to Mrs. De Wint.
Number 5 Bolton Street, Piccadilly, June 12th. Dearest Bessie, you will see that we have left that terrible, hateful, fatal house. How I wish we had escaped from it sooner. Oh, my dear Bessie, I shall never be the same woman again if I live to be 100. Let me try to be coherent and to tell you connectedly what has happened. And first, as to the housemaid. She has been removed to a lunatic asylum, where she remains in much the same state. She has had several lucid intervals, and during them has been closely, pressingly questioned as to what it was she saw. But she has maintained an absolute, hopeless silence, and only shudders, moans, and hides her face in her hands when the subject is broached. 3 days ago I went to see her, and on my return was sitting resting in the drawing-room before going to dress for dinner, talking to Adela about my visit, when Ralph Gordon walked in. He has always been walking in the last 10 days, and Adela has always flushed up and looked very happy, poor little cat, whenever he made his appearance. He looked very handsome, dear fellow, just come in from the park, seemed in tremendous spirits, and was as sceptical as even you could be as to the ghostly origin of Sarah's seizure. "Let me come here tonight and sleep in that room, do, Mrs. Montresor," he said, looking very eager and excited. "With the gas lit and a poker, I'll engage to exorcise every demon that shows his ugly nose, even if I should find 7 white ghostesses sitting on 7 white postesses." "You don't mean really?" I asked incredulously.
"Don't I? That's all,"
he answered emphatically.
"I should like nothing better. Well, is it a bargain?"
Adela turned quite pale. "Oh, don't," she said hurriedly. "Please don't. Why should you run such a risk? How do you know that you might not be sent mad too?" He laughed very heartily and coloured a little with pleasure at seeing the interest she took in his safety.
"Never fear," he said. "It would take more than a whole squadron of departed ones with the old gentleman at their head to send me crazy."
He was so eager, so persistent, so thoroughly in earnest, that I yielded at last, though with a certain strong reluctance, to his entreaties. Adela's blue eyes filled with tears, and she walked away hastily to the conservatory and stood picking bits of heliotrope to hide them. Nevertheless, Rafe got his own way. It was so difficult to refuse him anything. We gave up all our engagements for the evening, and he did the same with his. At about 10 o'clock he arrived, accompanied by a friend and brother officer, Captain Burton, who was anxious to see the result of the experiment.
"Let me go up at once,"
he said, looking very happy and animated.
"I don't know when I have felt in such good tune. A new sensation is a luxury not to be had every day of one's life. Turn the gas up as high as it will go, provide a good stout poker, and leave the issue to Providence and me."
We did as he bid.
"It's all ready now,"
Henry said, coming downstairs after having obeyed his orders.
"The room is nearly as light as day. Well, good luck to you, old fellow." "Goodbye, Miss Bruce,"
Rafe said, going over to Adela and taking her hand with a look, half laughing, half sentimental.
"Fare thee well, and if forever, then forever fare thee well. That is my last dying speech and confession. Now mind,"
he went on, standing by the table and addressing us all,
"if I ring once, don't come. I may be flurried and lay hold of the bell without thinking. If I ring twice, come."
Then he went, jumping up the stairs 3 steps at a time and humming a tune. As for us, we sat in different attitudes of expectation and listening about the drawing room. At first we tried to talk a little, but it would not do. Our whole soul seemed to have passed into our ears. The clock's ticking sounded as loud as a great church bell close to one's ear. Addie lay on the sofa with her dear little white face hidden in the cushions. So we sat for exactly an hour, but it seemed like 2 years. And just as the clock began to strike 11, a sharp ting, ting, ting rang clear and shrill through the house. "Let us go," said Addie, starting up and running to the door. "Let us go," I cried too, following her. But Captain Burton stood in the way and intercepted our progress.
"No,"
he said decisively.
"You must not go. Remember, Gordon told us distinctly, if he rang once, not to come. I know the sort of fellow he is, and that nothing would annoy him more than having his directions disregarded."
"Oh, nonsense," Addie cried passionately. "He would never have rung if he had not seen something dreadful. Do let us go," she ended, clasping her hands. But she was overruled, and we all went back to our seats. 10 more minutes of suspense, next door to unendurable. I felt a lump in my throat, a gasping for breath. 10 minutes on the clock, but 1,000 centuries on our hearts. Then again, loud, sudden, violent, the bell rang. We made a simultaneous rush to the door. I don't think we were 1 second flying upstairs. Addie was first. Almost simultaneously, she and I burst into the room. There he was, standing in the middle of the floor. Rigid, petrified, with that same look. That look that is burnt into my heart in letters of fire. Of awful, unspeakable, stony fear on his brave young face. For one instant he stood thus. Then, stretching out his arm stiffly before him, he groaned in a terrible husky voice. "Oh, my God, I have seen it." And fell down, dead. Yes, dead. Not in a swoon or in a fit, but dead. Vainly we tried to bring back the life to that strong young heart. It will never come back again till that day when the earth and the sea give up the dead that are therein. I cannot see the page for the tears that are blinding me. He was such a dear fellow. I can't write any more today. You're broken-hearted, Cecilia.
The This is a true story.
That was Ali Silva with her recitation of Rhoda Broughton's tale, The Truth, The Whole Truth, and Nothing But the Truth. While there's no denying that this story was a terrific spine tingler, I have to be honest with you, there were a few references made along the way that left me a little puzzled and aroused my curiosity. A little research shed some interesting light. First, the Hussars. A Hussar was a member of a class of light cavalry, originating in Eastern and Central Europe during the 15th and 16th centuries, originally Hungarian. The title and distinctive dress of these horsemen were widely adopted by light cavalry regiments in European and European colonial armies in the late 17th and 18th centuries. The 12 British Hussar regiments were distinguished by different colored busby bags and a few other distinctions, such as the yellow plumes of the 20th, the buff collars of the 13th, and the crimson breeches of the 11th Hussar Regiment. Another reference. When Elizabeth describes the heaven-like comfort and amenities of the apartment she has found for her friend, she states that there are lounges suited to every possible physical conformation, from the Apollo Belvedere to Miss Biffin. This line contains two very clever but by today's standards obscure references. The Apollo Belvedere is a highly regarded statue from the classical period. It depicts the Greek god with his arms stretched wide after having shot an arrow. For contrast, this work of art is compared to Miss Biffin, otherwise known as Sarah Biffin, a celebrity in Rhoda Broughton's Victorian England. Sarah was a gifted painter who happened to be born without arms. Lastly, and perhaps most intriguing of all the obscure references, was the Cock Lane Ghost. The Cock Lane Ghost was a story that attracted much publicity in 1762. Crowds of people gathered from far and wide, making the modest street impassable in the hopes of witnessing some kind of paranormal activity. With its backstory of a strange love triangle and a spirit seeking vengeance from beyond the grave, it provided inspiration for cultural figures such as Charles Dickens and William Hogarth. In case you're wondering, after an investigation, the British authorities declared the hauntings a hoax, and the landlord of the property found himself placed in the stockade for perpetrating a fraud upon the public. Some more about tonight's author, Rhoda Broughton. One could argue that creating dark fiction was something of a birthright for her. After all, the Irish Grand Master of the Macabre, Joseph Sheridan Le Fanu, author of the original vampire novel, Carmilla, was not only her uncle, but also her mentor and earliest supporter. He published Rhoda's first works in his Dublin University magazine and helped to launch her career by introducing her to various notable publishers. Her work, unfortunately, is largely out of print today, but we encourage you to try to lay your hands on a copy of Twilight Stories from 1872, which contains the story you just heard along with some other notable exercises in terror and suspense. Also highly recommended is Victorian Ghost Stories by Eminent Women Writers, edited by Richard Dalby and published by Running Press in 1993. This volume also contains the story you just heard, but in addition provides a terrific introduction to some special authors with spectral tendencies that have long been waiting to be rediscovered. The Midnight Reading is produced by Gustavo Rodriguez and Ali Silva for Fireside Mystery Productions. Our audio engineer is Wayne Silver, and our series was recorded at the Ice Plant Studio in New York City. Ali Silva edited and supervised post-production. This collection was curated in our series written by Sylvan Sandovar. Our theme music is by Martina De Silva. This is James Reeser, strongly encouraging you to explore and discover the bewitching appeal of dark literature at your local bookstore or library. Thank you, kind listeners, for joining us. And until next time, be sure to mind the shadows.